If you would, tonight, get your Bibles out and open to the book of 2 Kings. We're going tonight to chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5 is the text we'll be looking at. And if you look at the heading in your Bible as to what that text is about, you should recognize that right away. 2 Kings chapter 5 is the story of the cleansing of Naaman, the leper. Preachers love 2 Kings chapter 5. This is the text we look at a lot. I've got probably half a dozen or better sermons from this text. And we talk about Naaman because he's such a great illustration of several things. Remember, he was the Syrian captain, or really general, the way we would look at things, who was a leper, and the little Hebrew servant girl had said, well, there's a prophet in Israel who could cure that leprosy. And so he came to the prophet, but the prophet didn't even come out to meet him. Elisha just sent his messenger out, told him to go dip in the Jordan River 7 times. And Naaman was just livid about that. I think it was beneath his dignity not to be addressed by someone in a little superior position. But he said, behold, I thought the prophet would come and wave his hand over the place and call on the name of his God. And don't we have better rivers at home than the Jordan? That doesn't make any sense. He was about ready to go home mad. But some of his servants said, Master, if he'd have told you to do something great, wouldn't you have done it? Well, how much more just some simple thing like that? So he went and dipped in Jordan, and he came back, and sure enough, he was cleansed just like the prophet had said. And we seize on that particular expression sometimes in verse 11 when he says, behold, I thought, because so often when people approach God, we have preconceived notions like that about how it ought to go and what God ought to require of us and what the process ought to be. And often it turns out to be something different than what we thought it was going to be. What I'd like for us to look at tonight, though, is something a little beyond that portion of the story. Naaman's thinking is also interesting to me, not only in that part of the story, but then once he was cleansed. In verse 15, he returned to the man of God with all his company and came and stood before him. And he said, behold now, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now. But Elisha answered him, verse 16. He said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And he urged him to take it. But he refused. Naaman said, if not, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth. For your servant will no longer offer burnt offering, nor will he sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord, that is, to Jehovah. Naaman says, if you're not going to take any gifts from me, at least let me take some dirt back home. What's that got to do with anything? Well, it seems as though that Naaman was kind of thinking that while there is no God anywhere but the God of Israel, that somehow the God of Israel needed to be worshipped in Israel. He had to go back home to Syria or Aram, where he was from. And it's almost like he's saying, well, if I can't worship him here, let me take a little Israel back home with me, and then I'll be able to worship him. Or at the very least, he seems to think that somehow that will help with reference to his offerings. Because he's no longer going to offer burnt offerings in the other places, but maybe with some sort of help with this dirt, he can put that under an altar and worship God. So I'm not sure exactly what he was thinking about that, but there seemed to be some connection there. And then he also was thinking about a problem that he was going to have. He said, verse 18, in this matter may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon, that was one of the Syrian gods, when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. Now, he said, I know there's no God but Jehovah. There's no God but the Lord. And he's the only one I will worship. And then he got to thinking about going back home and being there with the king and having to go into the house of Rimmon and being expected to bow with the king, and that would be insisted upon. He said, please pardon me when I have to do that. I'm not really bowing to him in my heart, even though I may be obliged to do that. And I like that about Naaman. He's really trying to think ahead and anticipate potential conflicts that might arise and how he's going to deal with all of that. And Elisha just kind of dismissed all of that. He said, "Go in peace." So he departed and went home, at least on the way home. That brings me to the portion of the text that I want us to focus on tonight. And it's not Naaman's thinking. It's the thinking of another man in the story who's just introduced to us in the next verse, in verse 20. His name is Gehazi. Gehazi is Elisha's servant. I don't know that he is the messenger that Elisha sent out to Naaman with the instructions of what to do. The Bible never indicates that. He may have been, but he was just a servant in the house of Elisha. And he's been watching all of that. He's been listening to all this and taking it in. And I want us to think with me, think together tonight, I'd like you to think with me about Gehazi's thinking. Because it's not quite right. It's interesting, but I don't think it's quite right. But it's so often kind of the way we think about things at times. So let's see if we can see ourselves in this story. Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, "Behold, my master has spared this Naaman the Aramean by not receiving from his hands what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." My master has spared this man. This man's an enemy. This man is a Syrian or an Aramean. The Arameans had been enemies of Israel for several hundred years now. If you read back in 1 Kings chapter 11, in the closing days of Solomon's reign, when Solomon's heart had turned away from the Lord, it wasn't as faithful as it should have been, the Lord raised up several enemies against Solomon. And one of those enemies, it's mentioned in 1 Kings chapter 11, was a man by the name of Rezon, R-E-Z-O-N, who was kind of a fugitive from a kingdom of Zobah, which was up in the northern part of what is Syria today. And he had fled because David had attacked Zobah and pretty well wiped that out and brought it under control. But he was a fugitive from that. And he'd made his way to Damascus and during Solomon's day kind of gathered a force around him and began to rule from Damascus. And that became then the capital later on of this nation of Syria or the Arameans. And they were kind of a constant thorn in Israel's side for a long time after that. In the closing chapters of the book of 1 Kings, the Syrians and the Israelites went to war pretty much every year for several years. And it was in one of those battles that King Ahab was killed. And Ahab and Jehoshaphat had gone up together. Maybe you remember studying about that. So here's a man who is a general in the opposing army that for several hundred years has been an enemy of the people of Israel. And even now they're conducting what we might call today border raids across. In fact, how this man happened to learn that there might be some help for his leprosy in Israel is verse 2 of our text says the Arameans had gone out in bands and taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel. And she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, "I wish that my master were the prophet, then he would heal me." So in these border raids, they're taking slaves, captive, taking them back. So you can understand how an Israelite might look with great disdain at a Syrian. And this man's a general in the army there. And he comes with leprosy. I almost wonder how Gehazi may have even felt about the leprosy. Maybe he kind of felt like, well, he's getting what he deserves. And then when Elisha cleansed him of that, you almost wonder if maybe Gehazi had a little bit of resentment about that. But maybe he was humanitarian enough that he He wouldn't have wished that on even his worst enemy. And so he could appreciate the fact that the man had been cleansed, and surely had to appreciate the fact that Naaman had turned and acknowledged the unique greatness of God and was going to make an effort to try to serve him. But there was just something about the situation that Gehazi doesn't seem right. It's just not fair for him to come down here and get this blessing, this enemy of ours, and go back home, and it didn't cost him anything, and he's not punished in any way for his wrongs. And what? There's just something not right about that in his way of thinking. You ever find yourself thinking that? Sure seems like somebody's getting away with something, and it's just not right. And somebody needs to do something about that. We just have the idea that somehow an enemy ought to be avenged in some way. And maybe I'm just the person to do it in some way. Well, if we ever get to thinking like Gehazi did, I want us to remember what the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 12. Let's read a few verses together there. Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 17. Romans 12, beginning in verse 17. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. And if he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We just need to read those verses every once in a while. Because that sense of getting even with somebody, that just crops up every once in a while in our thinking, doesn't it? And that seems to be Gehazi's thinking. My master has spared this Aramean. But to him, that wasn't right. And so he decided he would take it upon himself to correct that situation. And he says, as the Lord lives, I will go after him and take something from him. I think that's interesting. Elisha had said to Naaman, when Naaman was offering to pay something, to give some sort of a gift, Elisha said, verse 16, as the Lord lives, I will take nothing. Gehazi said, as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something. Just as surely as Elisha was determined to take nothing on this occasion, Gehazi was just as determined that he was going to correct this situation that he thought was wrong. So part of his motive in what he did, to me, is a kind of a correctional thing, an element of punishment there. The other part of his motive is financial. You see, Naaman, when he came to Elisha's house, came prepared to pay a great sum of money. Look back at verse 5. The king of Aram said to him, go now, I will send a letter to the king of Israel. And so Naaman departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothes. As the story unfolds, he has several servants traveling with him in doubt, in part helping them to carry all of this. There's an entourage traveling together here. I wish I could tell you exactly how much money 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold was. But I really don't know how to put that in today's terms. I'll just put it this way. It was a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money. And 10 changes of clothes. Now, that doesn't mean as much to us because we all got closets full of 10 or 20 or 30 changes of clothes. But in that day and time, that was one of the great measures of someone's wealth. And that was a lot. And think about this from Gehazi's perspective. That's probably more money than Gehazi had ever seen in his lifetime. That's more clothes than he could have dreamed of ever owning. Remember what conditions are like in Israel. This is the time of Elijah and then Elisha. Well, in the time of Elijah and Elisha, this is the time of moral degradation in the land. And a part of the problem with that is God is bringing some punishment on them. They've had a lot of famines. They've had droughts. Things are tough. Elijah had to be fed by ravens for a while he was hiding out. He went to visit a widow, and she had such a little amount of food that when he asked her for something, she said, "I've only got enough for me and my son. We're going to have one more meal, and we're going to die because we're out of food." Things were tough along during that time. And here comes this Syrian general with chariots loaded full of money and clothes. And probably in Gehazi's thinking, he said, "Yeah, some of that was our stuff that you took in these border raids and took back home again." And then there was something else. It was customary when people went to visit a prophet to offer some sort of a gift to the prophet. Do you remember the story of King Saul when he was, before he was the king, when he was out looking for his father's lost donkeys? He and his servant were out looking, but they'd been looking for several days. They hadn't found anything. And finally, the servant said, "Well, there's a seer, or there's a prophet over here in this particular town. Maybe we can go talk to him, and he'll give us an answer where to look." And Saul said, "Well, we don't have anything to give him. We didn't bring a gift with us, you see." That was the custom. And maybe Gehazi is thinking, you know, it's the custom for people to pay when they come to see a prophet and get a benefit. And we're poor. Elisha's poor. I'm poor. We've got nothing. Times are poor. And here's this man, and he comes and he gets cleansed of leprosy, and he's loaded with money, and we let him go home free? Like, you see how those wheels are turning in there? And he thinks, this is not right. This isn't right. And so he says, "As the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." And he seems to be thinking, not only will that be fair, but that'll be great. I'll really enjoy whatever it is that I'm able to take away from you. Now, honesty or dishonesty aside for the moment, let's just think about that disposition. That somehow we're going to be better off if we have more stuff. Somehow, when we see all that maybe is more than we've ever seen and maybe we've ever hoped to accumulate in our lifetime, said, "Boy, if I could just have that, life would be great." That seems to be kind of what he's thinking. Let me remind you of what Solomon wrote about that. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, beginning in verse 10. In Ecclesiastes 5, beginning in verse 10, Solomon said, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When goods increase, those who consume them increase. So what's the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep." He says, "There's a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his own hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. As he came naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. this is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Solomon lived several hundred years before Gehazi. Gehazi would probably have done well to have learned a little bit from Solomon, though. Solomon had it all. He had more money than anyone ever had, probably before or after him. And Solomon said, that doesn't bring any meaning to life. That's not what it's all about. So Gehazi's thinking on that point was a little crooked too. But, well, let's read the story. Let's see what he did. He said, as the Lord lives, I will run after him and I will take something from him. So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well? He said, all is well. My master has sent me saying, behold now, just now, two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothes. Naaman said, be pleased to take two talents. And he urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of clothes and gave them to two of his servants, and they carried them before him. When they came to the hill, he took them from their hand and deposited them in the house and sent the men away, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master. Gehazi had to figure out some kind of a way to make this work. And he didn't want to just run out there and say, well, we've changed our mind. We'll take all that stuff you were offering us a while ago. Well, that would be a little obvious, wouldn't it? So he made up this tale about these two sons of the prophets coming and made it sound like, you know, I don't need anything and Elisha doesn't need anything, but those two sons of the prophets could use some help. So if the offer's still good, we'll take a little something for them. And Naaman says, well, here, take some extra. Oh, no, we don't need it. Oh, please, take some extra. Well, okay, if you insist. And so he took all that back home. You can just see how that conversation went, can't you? What's Gehazi thinking here? Evidently, Gehazi's thinking, Naaman needs some sort of punishment. I'm underpaid and Elisha's underpaid and it's not fair that this man's getting off doing nothing. So I'm going to straighten this out. And if I have to tell a little lie in the process of straightening it out, well, that's okay. Because it'll rectify this otherwise wrong situation. That seems to be kind of his thought process, isn't it? That somehow this end that he's convinced himself of, that's a legitimate end, justifies dishonesty, deceit, and achieving that end. And he's certainly not alone in the thinking that somehow if we've got some sort of a good goal in mind, some noble cause, that however we get there doesn't matter too much. That kind of thinking just seems to be most everywhere. It's taken over in politics in our country. People have the idea that our political agenda of our party, whichever party it is so important that it doesn't matter if we lie, it doesn't matter if we misrepresent ourselves or what we're going to do or our opponents or anything else. It doesn't matter how abusive we are in our language. It doesn't matter how dishonorable we are in our conduct. If we can just get this passed, if we can get this done, that's all that matters. And even if we have to circumvent the legal processes to get it done, well, so be it. That's really discouraging to me, to see the leaders of our country taking those kinds of approaches to things. It happens in the courts. Occasionally a judge will rule, not because of what the law says in this case, but because of what the judge thinks the law ought to say. That's So he'll just set aside what the law really says and just rule it the way he thinks it ought to be. Happens in sports. How many times do you hear about some college program that gets caught cheating, breaking the rules, so we can get a few more athletes in here and that might help us win the championship? Or coaches that just don't seem to think a thing about using all sorts of abusive and horrible language and whatever. Anything to motivate a team, doesn't matter. And players that will take all kinds of drugs and shortcuts and whatever else just because we got to get there. We got to win. Happens in business. And I'll tell you what, this kind of thinking just makes its way into religion too. There are just a lot of folks that have convinced ourselves religiously that if we've got some sort of a good goal in mind, it doesn't make quite so much difference. We don't need to be just real careful about how we get there. Like getting the gospel out to everybody. It's become the thought process that if we can just get people here, whatever it takes to get them here is okay. If we can just get them here, maybe we can even teach them a little bit while they're here. And so people have just gone to all sorts of carnal appeals and gimmicks and games and whatever just to try to get a crowd. Of course, all that stuff's expensive. And so we start coming up with all kinds of ways to pay for it that the New Testament doesn't know anything about. Sometimes in debates, religious debates, people don't act very honorably because they're so intent on winning the debate, winning the discussion. That even happens sometimes when a local church gets in a fuss. Brethren are so concerned about getting their way that they'll resort to misrepresentation and intimidation and whatever else. Folks, we've got to get rid of that kind of thinking. That somehow, if we've got some sort of an end that in our minds is a good one, it doesn't much matter how we get there. The Apostle Paul roundly rebuked this kind of thinking in Romans, the 3rd chapter, in verse 4. There were some people who were saying of him that he preaches, let us do good so that evil may come. No, let me rephrase that. Let us do evil so that good may come. That's what they were saying. They were accusing Paul of actually advocating unlawfulness so that the grace of God could shine even better. Paul advocated no such thing. That principle is just not right. Gehazi's thinking was wrong when he got to thinking that if I've got a good end, it doesn't really matter too much how I get there. And if I have to cut a few corners, I cut a few corners. So he makes up this lie. And he gets the stuff. Brings it back. Now, it won't do for him to have these servants of Naaman's be seen in town. So when they get there, they get this hill. And he just hides the stuff there. And he sends them away. In verse 25, he went in and stood before his master. Elisha said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, your servant went nowhere. Oh, I've been here all day. Been here right along. Nope, haven't been anywhere. That brings me to the fourth thing in Gehazi's thinking. He somehow thought he was going to get by with his sin. What made him think that? Well, if you think about it, his prospect of getting caught really was pretty slim. Because Naaman's on the way back home. And he's just going to follow him at some distance and catch him when he's well enough away from home that nobody back in Samaria is going to know about that. And he can tell his little story and he can get his stuff and he can bring it back home and hide it and slip back in the house and nobody's going to be the wiser. At least he thought that way. Of course, he forgot something. He is a prophet's servant. His master is a prophet of God. He's inspired of God. So I don't know whether Gehazi had really thought any of that through or not. You know, often we don't. there's something at the moment that's such a temptation. We don't stop and logically think, am I going to get by with this? Am I going to be able to pull this off or whatever? But how about with reference to God, without reference to other people? Did he think somehow he was going to be able to get away with this with reference to God? Maybe he reasoned he was justified, that Naaman really should have paid something for this service. Maybe he thought, well, God will understand. I'm poor, I don't have much, and so God will understand. People tell me that every once in a while. I know this isn't what the Bible says, but I think God will understand here. It's a little thing. He didn't take everything that Naaman was offering. It's just a little thing. Doesn't make that much difference. It's minor. I don't know whether he thought through any of that. But in verse 26, as the story continues, Elisha turned to him and said, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Is it a time to receive money and to receive clothes and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever." So he went out from his presence, a leper as white as snow. I don't know whether he thought he could get away with his sin or not, but if he did, he was wrong. God knew. The prophet knew. I've wondered when I read this story, exactly when and where was he going to wear these changes of clothes that he got? You ever thought about that? He's trying to hide this whole transaction. When's he going to wear this stuff that somebody's not going to see? Say, hey, where'd that come from anyway? You know. Sometimes when we get involved in wrongdoing, our thinking just really goes awry, doesn't it? Two observations before we close about his sin. Number one, his sin had consequences for him of a nature that he could not have imagined when he started out to get that money. Had he known that the outcome of this, that he would be a leper for the rest of his life, and not only he would be a leper, but anyone that he ever formed a family unit with, it would be on them forever. Had he known that, would it have changed his thinking about how valuable those clothes were and how valuable that money was? But he didn't foresee that. And that's the nature of sin. It affects us in ways that we don't anticipate until it happens. Moses told the children of Israel, "Be sure your sin will find you out." And he's not talking about an eternity in that verse, Numbers 23 and 32. He's talking, or 32, 23. He's talking about what happens right now. And the second thing is that Gehazi's sin affected other people in ways that he hadn't thought about either. You see, Elisha was trying to make a point. He was working on a principle here. Elisha was trying to differentiate himself with the false prophets of his day. And there were plenty of them. Ahab had 400 of them. And these were men who would readily have taken money for any kind of service or anything. They were all about that kind of thing. Probably if you gave enough money, they'd prophesy however you wanted them to prophesy. And Elisha is trying to say, no, there is a matter of right. There's a matter of principle. I am a prophet of God and we are different. And that's what he's saying to Gehazi when he says to him, "Is it a time to receive money and clothes and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants?" Not only is it a time to take advantage of this man in terms of his blessing, but is it a time in the bigger picture of things for us as prophets of God to be trying to act this way? Because what that would end up doing is undermining the prophetic office of Elisha. And that in turn would affect all the people that Elisha might be able to reach with the truth and turn them away from Baal worship, which is what he and Elijah, his predecessor, were working so hard to do. That's the nature of sin. it not only affects me personally, but it affects other people, and it affects them in ways that I don't even think about, sometimes I don't even know about. We don't live in a vacuum. How we behave or misbehave affects other people. So think somehow we can just get by with stuff. Well, that's just not right. We don't get by with it with God, and we often don't even get by with it with reference to other people. So this is a great story. And maybe we see ourselves in this character a little bit. Hopefully we'll learn something from him so we won't have to make the mistakes he made and learn these lessons the hard way. What a hard way to learn those lessons for Gehazi. Thanks for listening tonight. Let's get ready to sing our song of invitation. We like the story of Naaman because it tells us so simply that in order to receive God's blessing, we have to put our faith in His provisions and we have to comply with His conditions. And that hasn't changed all through the centuries. For our salvation, we still have to put our faith in God's provision, the gift of His Son and His blood shed on our behalf. And we have to comply with God's conditions. That kind of faith, a turning from sin, and somewhat like Naaman, a dipping, an immersion for cleansing. It's an immersion into the blood, into the death of Jesus Christ, Romans 6 and verse 3. And if there's someone tonight who would like to take that step, that you can be cleansed of your sin, let us know by coming to the front as we stand together and sing our song.